I'll tell you something funny about this collection. The first title was Too Jewish.
Oh my goodness, really?
Don't you think the stories are really too Jewish?
Shalom, and welcome to the Too Jewish radio show and podcast with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. This morning, Rabbi's guest is Rabbi Stuart Weinblatt, chairman of the Zionist Rabbinic Coalition. We'll also have a visit from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Please email your comments to us at 2JewishRadio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at 2JewishRadio.com. The opinions of the host and guests on 2 Jewish are their own and not those of the radio station. 2 Jewish is paid for by 2 Jewish Radio Programs and Podcasts, Tucson, Arizona. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and 2 Jewish.
Shalom and a very slightly early Chag Chanukah Sameach, a happy holiday of Chanukah. The major holiday of this season is finally here, the one we've awaited with such anticipation, the holiday that brings great joy in this season of short, colder days. That's right. Tonight is when we at last get to celebrate Chanukah. It begins at sundown, and for 8 crazy nights, our lives are filled with family, friends, latkes, candles, dreidels, gelt, songs, and sufganiyot. That word, Chanukah, means dedication, and it comes from the rededication of the temple in Jerusalem in the year 165 or so BCE, slightly less than 2,200 years ago. You probably know the story, but a little refresher never hurts. In the first purely religious persecution in all of human history, but of course not the last, the Syrian Greek Empire of the Seleucids tried to compel our Jewish people not to worship our God. Led by the tyrant emperor Antiochus IV Epiphanes, known to Jews as Antiochus, decrees went out requiring statues of Antiochus erected in every town in Israel. Particularly, a great statue of this evil king had to be placed in the Holy Temple in Jerusalem. To suppress the now outlawed religion of Judaism, the teaching of Torah was banned on punishment of death, and both circumcision and keeping kosher were made capital crimes. Any instruction of children in the ways of our ancestors was absolutely forbidden, and the laws were enforced by squads of soldiers armed with spears, swords, and bows and arrows, and sometimes riding elephants. To emphasize the religious subjugation of the Jews, distinctly unkosher pigs were sacrificed deliberately on the altar of the temple itself, and the lights of the sacred 7-branched menorah were extinguished. Judaism looked like it, too, was about to be extinguished, like the oil in the menorahs that was impurified and now couldn't even be used by Jews. It was at this time of greatest darkness that one family rose up and refused to bow down to the idol of Antiochus, the first real evil emperor. Led by Matityahu Mattathias in the Greek pronunciation, a family known as the Hasmoneans, the Hashmonai, struck back. At first, many Jews simply complied with Antiochus' demands. His army was the strongest in the world at that time. There seemed to be no alternative. But finally, the oppressed people of Israel could stand it no more. The rebellion began in an obscure town in the Judean hills called Modin, with the overthrow of a tax collector and a refusal to bow down to the statue of that king. The Hasmonean family, soon to be led by the most dynamic of Mattathias' sons, Judah, began a guerrilla war, maybe the first successful one in human history. Hiding out in caves and forests, striking out at the better armed and more numerous Seleucid armies, this was a careful campaign that gathered strength over time. In spite of the use of battle elephants brought from the Seleucid Empire's Indian possessions, they were kind of the M1 tank of that era, and in spite of all the military advantages that lay with the occupying power, the Jews, led by Judah the Hammer, that's Maccabean Hebrew, more or less, the Jews eventually gained the upper hand. The Syrian Greeks were driven from the main part of Israel and finally from the temple in Jerusalem, which was cleansed and prepared and turned again into proper condition for sanctification and ritual rites. The rededication took place at a great festival of thanksgiving, what we call now Hanukkah, from the word chinuch, meaning dedication. The lights of the Hanukkah menorah remind us today of the great miracle of our salvation from religious persecution, of the triumph of the few over the many, the weak over the strong, the believers over those who tried to destroy us. In a year when anti-Semitism is again on the rise all over the world, Hanukkah particularly reminds us of the hope that we will again triumph over those who would deny our right to exist as Jews and deny our right to our historic and current homeland. To play us in this morning on Too Jewish, here's the original version of a popular version of Al HaNisim, the prayer thanking God for the miracle of Hanukkah. This prayer is recited all through the 8 days of Hanukkah. This version comes from the Israeli Hasidic Festival of 1974, sung by Yisar Cohen. Al HaNisim ve'al HaPurkan ve'al HaGvurot ve'al HaTzuot ve'al HaMilchamot she'asit Rabotenu bayamim ha'em bazman hazeh. Al HaNisim ve'al HaPurkan ve'al HaGvurot ve'al HaTzuot ve'al HaMilchamot she'asit Rabotenu bayamim ha'em bazman hazeh. That was Al HaNisim for Hanukkah. Hanukkah begins tonight at sundown. You can join me, Rabbi Sam Cohen, for a virtual Hanukkah menorah lighting every night of Hanukkah on the Beit Simcha Facebook page. That's at 5:30 p.m. tonight. The page is facebook.com, Beit Simcha Tucson, B-E-I-T-S-I-M-C-H-A Tucson. Every night of Hanukkah, we'll have different Hanukkiot from my modest collection of about 150 Hanukkah menorahs, different songs, different stories, and candles. It's great fun. Even more important, coming up next Saturday night, December 20th, the best Hanukkah celebration in all of Arizona. Join us for Let There Be Light, the 7th anniversary of Congregation Beit Simcha on Saturday night, December 20th at 5 p.m. Great music, food, drink, celebration, and prizes. Go to BeitSimchaTucson.org, B-E-I-T-S-I-M-C-H-A Tucson.org to join us. Be a sponsor, a donor, or just attend. It's a fabulous evening of celebration of both Hanukkah and our 7-year-old congregation. When we come back in a moment on Too Jewish, our guest this morning will be Rabbi Stuart Weinblatt, chairman of the Zionist Rabbinic Coalition, a pretty new group of rabbis from all the movements of Judaism. Find out why it started, what it does, and how it seeks to accomplish even more. All when we come back in a moment on Too Jewish. We are delighted to welcome to Too Jewish our guest this morning. Rabbi Stuart Weinblatt is the founder of the Zionist Rabbinic Coalition and the chairman of it. He's Rabbi Emeritus of Congregation B'nai Tzedek in the Washington, D.C. area. And I recently had the privilege of attending and being part of a mission led by the by Rabbi Weinblatt to Azerbaijan and Israel on behalf of the Zionist Rabbinic Coalition. Extraordinary experience. Good morning and welcome to Two Jewish.
Hi, Sam. It's a pleasure to be with you. Thanks so much for this opportunity to speak with you and your listeners.
So tell us a little bit about the founding of the Zionist Rabbinic Coalition. You're a past president of the Rabbinic Cabinet of the Jewish Federations of North America, Jewish National Funds, Affinity Group, Rabbis for Israel. But tell us why the Zionist Rabbinic Coalition came about and how.
Well, to tell you the truth, the reason for it being started is that there really was nothing out there like what we are doing. It's a coalition of rabbis from all different movements who are committed to Jewish unity, to Zionism, and being supportive of Israel. It started, after the United States declared it was going to recognize Jerusalem as the capital and move our embassy there, the response of some of the national rabbinic organizations was surprisingly tepid. And as a result, Israel's ambassador to the United States at the time, Ron Dermer, had asked me to do something. He said, I can't believe, you know, this represents the voice of American rabbis. And so we traveled to Israel, met with people there, a group of rabbis, about 21 of us. And out of that, there was a sense that no one is really speaking up on the national scene with a voice of support for Israel in the rabbinic community. Hard as that may sound. So the response that I get when we talk about the Zionist Rabbinic Coalition is one of two things. Either, thank God you're doing this, and or I can't believe it's necessary. And so it was started just a few years ago, and we've already grown to a network of over about 1,600 rabbis or so who share the same commitment to wanting to be supportive of Israel and of Zionism.
It is indeed shocking that there wasn't really such a national organization. Why do you think that was?
Well, I think, first of all, you know, at one time AIPAC had an active synagogue and rabbinic division, but now that they've shifted their gear, and appropriately so, towards political campaigns and things like that, it's been more difficult to have a nonpartisan rabbinic presence. The other organizations which may have rabbinic cabinets don't necessarily do what we're trying to do. They really are primarily supporting the work and the very worthwhile work of these other organizations. So, you know, it's interesting, Stan, because out there, there are so many organizations with rabbinic voices who are very publicly and very loudly critical of Israel. I'm referring to TRUA, which is known as Rabbis for Human Rights, Jewish Voices for Peace, or I should say the so-called Jewish Voices for Peace, If Not Now, Bend the Ark, New Jewish Narrative, Rabbis for a Ceasefire, even though now that there's a ceasefire, they refuse to disband. So those are really an echo chamber, as well as J Street, to be perfectly honest, an echo chamber of those who are publicly and unabashedly critical of Israel. We think that the American rabbis need to take a different position, which is to show our love and our support for Israel. It doesn't mean that it's unconditional, doesn't mean that it's blind, but it means that at the end of the day, we stand with Israel.
We will talk much more with Rabbi Stuart Weinblatt about the Zionist Rabbinic Coalition, about support for Israel, and about the recent mission trip when we come back in a moment here on Two Jewish. Beit Simcha, the House of Joy, a fabulous Jewish synagogue in the northwest of Tucson in the Catalina foothills, celebrates a great array of services, classes, and events this winter. Established 7 years ago by terrific congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, Beit Simcha has created a vibrant, vital community that strives every day to serve God with joy. Progressive congregation in northwest Tucson and the foothills, Beit Simcha is open to everybody throughout the metropolitan area, providing weekly Shabbat services, youth and adult education academy courses, social justice opportunities, outreach, and cultural Jewish programming. Join us in person for Shabbat services or come on Facebook Live. We welcome members and guests. Call 520-276-5675. That's 520-276-5675. Religious school is going great for school-aged children and grandchildren. Come to our fabulous Hebrew school, Bar and Bat Mitzvah programs, Torah Tikes, Confirmation, Teen programs, all in a fun, relaxed setting with great Jewish learning for every age. Join us for Congregation Beit Simcha's 7th anniversary celebration Saturday night, December 20th at 5 p.m. Let there be light, music, latkes, food, drink, fun, and of course, menorah lighting. Go to BeitSimchaTucson.org, B-E-I-T-S-I-M-C-H-A, Tucson.org to sign up for the finest Hanukkah celebration in all of Arizona. And attend our virtual menorah lighting every night of Hanukkah at 5:30 p.m. on our Facebook page, facebook.com, Beit Simcha Tucson, B-E-I-T-S-I-M-C-H-A Tucson. All of our services, classes, and events are open to everybody. Come Friday night, services are at 6:30 p.m., always followed by a delicious Onig Shabbat. Saturday morning, services are 10 a.m., all with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, leading them. Facebook page is Beit Simcha Tucson, B-E-I-T-S-I-M-C-H-A Tucson. And our services are available there. All of our Adult Education Academy classes are live and on Zoom. You can find those on our website, BeitSimchaTucson.org. For more about Beit Simcha, to come to services, religious school and Torah Tikes programs, bar and bat mitzvah, confirmation, high school programs, weddings, rich array of Adult Education Academy courses taught live and on Zoom, and all of our services in person and on Facebook, go to BeitSimchaTucson.org. Don't miss December 20th, Saturday night, 5 p.m., our 7th anniversary and the 7th night of Hanukkah. Let there be light. Call 520-276-5675. That's 520-276-5675. Join me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, at Beit Simcha, fastest growing Jewish congregation in all of Southern Arizona. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, a kvetch or a kvel, please email us at tojewishradio18@gmail.com. That's T-O-O, jewishradio18@gmail. Or visit our website, tojewishradio.com, T-O-O, jewishradio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through our website, streaming us from there, downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store. It's a very popular Jewish podcast. Top 10 in America, according to Moment Magazine, over 250,000 downloads on Podbean and on Spotify, too. Post a rating, review Too Jewish wherever you listen to us. Those comments all help. The stories we share last a lifetime and are passed down from generation to generation. Known for our compassionate commitment to the families we serve, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has faithfully served the Tucson community and the Jewish community for over 100 years. We help thousands of families plan and carry out celebrations of loved ones in unique and special ways and assist them in sharing those lifetimes of stories meaningfully. The most beautiful and tranquil final resting place in all of Southern Arizona, Evergreen's tall pines shade peaceful grassy fields. You can count on Evergreen for superior service and the highest degree of integrity. Our informative, well-trained staff is here to assist you with a full range of on-site services. Call Evergreen, 520-888-7470, 520-888-7470. While we serve the whole community, our experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. We have sections dedicated to all religious faiths, can help you arrange for your future needs or your immediate ones. Whether you choose to hold a traditional funeral service or a completely individualized ceremony, either in person or online or both, our goal is to help you create a meaningful, personalized service based upon your unique needs in a place of reflection, tradition, and serenity. Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best to the community and to you. Call 520-888-7470. To speak to a family advisor at Evergreen, call 520-888-7470. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
Last time we were talking about the Caucasus, and it brought to mind that while I was in Azerbaijan, in the Jewish Museum, in the only Jewish, majority Jewish village outside of Israel in the world, the Red Village, I saw a display in the Jewish Museum about the Radanites, these Jewish merchant traders who traveled from Spain to China in the darkest parts of the Middle Ages. And I'd happened to write a I wrote an undergraduate paper thesis on it for the history department at UCLA about a trillion years ago, which led me to note that Michael Chabon, the novelist, wrote a book about it called Gentlemen of the Road, which is unfortunately a terrible book. But he also wrote Cavalier and Clay, which is an excellent book. And when I mentioned that, you noted that you had not only read it and another of his books, but there's a personal connection. So tell us about it.
Yeah. So Cavalier and Clay were based on real people named Schuster and Siegel. Anyway, it turns out, and this is just such a wild coincidence, they are family. My mother's family was dispersed all over, but originally came from Odessa. And when we were taken by my parents to the New York World's Fair in 1964, on a hot summer Sunday, we went out to Long Island, sit on their patio and have barbecue and meet Siegel and Schuster. And, you know, they took us down to their basement and showed us where they first began Superman, you know, 20 years earlier. And we were just enthralled. For us, it wasn't the World's Fair that was the highlight of that trip. It was meeting the guys who created Superman and that whole world.
So there's a lot about Superman, and, you know, that was a kind of Jewish response to all of the persecutions and the developed rise of the Nazis in the 30s, that's where Siegel and Schuster got the inspiration for Superman. Did they tell you any of that stuff? Like, that would really be great.
Sam, my brother and I were like 9 and 12 at the time. So they didn't tell us about their
internal motivations and their political ethics.
We were really little kids, but we were very impressed by that part of the family pedigree, which we had no idea of. We had very few relatives on my mother's side in St. Louis. My father's side was a different story. But that was quite a highlight of my childhood.
That's a great story. Tom, you have so many stories. When are you writing the book?
Yeah, right. Join the line.
I will purchase a copy, I promise, and we will promote it on Too Jewish Heavily.
Great.
Tom, thanks for that memory, and we'll talk next week.
I look forward to it.
It's time now for our Old Jewish Joke of the Week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. As the jets settled down on the tarmac at Ben Gurion Airport, the voice of the captain came over the loudspeakers. Welcome to Israel, Bruchim Habayim. Please remain seated with your seatbelt fastened until this plane is at a complete standstill and the seatbelt signs have been turned off. To those of you who remain quietly in your seats, we wish you a Merry Christmas. To those of you standing in the aisle, struggling with your suitcases, we wish you a Happy Hanukkah. You see, the Israelis, the Jews, they all get up before they're supposed to. Never mind. That was the Old Jewish Joke of the Week, special feature of Too Jewish just for you. You should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. In this week's portion of Miketz, we're in the midst of the fabulous story of Joseph, now shorn of his technicolor dream coat and locked away in an Egyptian prison. Dreams will play a central role, not for the first time in Genesis and not for the first time in the story of Joseph. In Miketz, Pharaoh, king of Egypt, dreams a famous dream. 7 fat cows emerge from the Nile River and then are devoured by 7 skinny cows. Then 7 fat ears of grain are eaten by 7 lean ears of grain. What does it mean? None of Egyptian king's brilliant advisors and counselors can help. In desperation, the Pharaoh turns to a forgotten Hebrew prisoner who once assisted his chief wine steward, his bartender, when he was in jail with him. Joseph is dragged from prison, cleaned up, brought to the Pharaoh, most powerful man in that part of the world at that time. The young Hebrew hears the dream and correctly interprets it, prophesying 7 years of plenty to be followed by 7 years of famine. Giving full credit to God as his only source of insight, Joseph helps the Pharaoh to save Egypt, and things go well both for him and Egypt. Joseph rises to great prominence, second in command of the whole country, and the Pharaoh's power is multiplied while his people are saved from destruction. Joseph marries an Egyptian woman and has 2 children, but oddly, his great success, his fame throughout Egypt, and his new family aren't quite enough for him. He misses his father, left behind in Canaan, and pines for his younger brother Benjamin, only living reminder of his dead mother, Rachel. Joseph never expects to see his father and full brother again. He misses his Hebrew identity, too. I guess you can take the boy out of Canaan, but you can't really take the Canaan out of the boy. And then in a plot twist worthy of the finest novel, Joseph's brothers are compelled by famine to come down to Egypt to buy bread. Suddenly, the same characters who beat him and sold him into slavery are in his complete power. What an amazing opportunity for revenge. Joseph seems primed to take advantage. He teases and torments his brothers, he fully aware of their identity and they completely ignorant of his. What will happen? As the Torah portion concludes, we are left wondering just how it will all go. Next week, we get the answer. This week, however, the issue is clearly delineated. How will an assimilated Jew respond to direct pressure to hide his own identity? Just as the Jews in the days of the Maccabees struggled with tremendous pressure to accept cultural subjugation and give up their Judaism, so Joseph struggled with hiding his identity or admitting it in public. In a season in which the majority culture overwhelms us with songs, foods, and religious trappings, we Jews, too, sometimes struggle to assert our pride in our own Jewish identities. May we learn from the lessons of Joseph and the Maccabees that Jewish identity must be asserted proudly and with commitment, in all times and seasons, in all situations. Happy Hanukkah. When we return in a moment on To Jewish, our guest, Rabbi Stuart Weinblatt, chair and founder of the Zionist Rabbinic Coalition, explains what role rabbis play in supporting Israel now and discusses the generational divide on Jewish support for Israel and how we might address it. Find out when we come back in a moment here on To Jewish.
We continue with our Two Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary from Rabbi Sam Kohan.
Just in time for Hanukkah, the first material evidence of battle in the Hasmonean uprising against the Seleucid Syrian Greeks has been located near Jerusalem in Israel. Dr. Devir Raviv of Bar-Ilan University says a survey at Chorbat Beit Zecharia in the Gush Etzion region south of Jerusalem uncovered objects that match both the date and the military profile of a famous battle described in the Book of Maccabees that took place in 163 BCE. The site, a hill about 7 kilometers southwest of Bethlehem, is widely identified with the ancient village of Beit Zecharia, where the Seleucid army and the forces of Judah Maccabee clashed in what is known as the Fifth Maccabean Battle. According to the book First Maccabees and to later Jewish historian Josephus, the Seleucid army advanced north along the Jerusalem-Hebron road with war elephants. In the most dramatic scene, Judah's brother Eleazar ran under the largest elephant and killed it and was crushed to death beneath its body. Raviv's survey at the site documented 92 coins and hundreds of pottery shards from the Persian, Hellenistic, and Hasmonean periods, but what drew his special attention were 4 objects that pointed directly to a Hellenistic battlefield, 3 cast lead sling bullets, and a bronze coin minted in the city of Side in Asia Minor, that is today located in southern Turkey. This is the first time we may be holding objects that came from one of Judah Maccabee's battlefields, Raviv said. At Beit Zecharia, we found a Side coin that is usually linked with Seleucid mercenaries and 3 lead sling bullets that only appear in military contexts. Together, they fit very well with the description of the battle in the First Maccabees book. The sling bullets, discovered on the western slope of a hill, are typical of Hellenistic ammunition. One has the winged thunderbolt of Zeus on it, a common symbol on such projectiles. Across Israel, similar sling bullets have been found at only about 20 sites, almost all known from historical sources to be siege works, forts, or battlefields, including Jerusalem, Dor, Samaria, Maresha, Yodfat, and Mount Gerizim. You do not expect to find Seleucid military equipment in a small rural village unless an army actually fought there, Raviv explained. So we have the first archaeological evidence of a Maccabean battle just in time for Hanukkah tonight. In other news, one of the greatest architects of all time, Los Angeles-based Frank Gehry, died last week at the age of 96.
Architects may come and architects may go and never change your point of view. When I run dry, I stop a while and think of you.
Architect Frank O. Gehry, who brought an alluringly new kind of shape-making to his profession, even as he fundamentally changed the reputation and civic landscape of his adopted hometown of Los Angeles in projects like the shimmering Walt Disney Concert Hall, passed away last week. Gehry arrived in L.A. as an aimless teenager just after World War II. He went on to become the most famous and one of the most influential architects in the world over a prolific six-decade career. Gehry had been widely respected among L.A. architects ever since the 1970s, but his global fame grew from high-level productivity late in his career and life. His firm, Gehry Partners, pioneered new ways to use technology to realize geometrically complicated buildings, beginning with the completion of an ambitious branch of the Guggenheim Museum in Bilbao, Spain. It opened to the public in 1997, the year Gehry turned 68, and was received rapturously. The Guggenheim Bilbao Museum was widely praised for its breathtaking and sinuous profile and dramatic relationship to the river below it. Also, it's really shiny. It helped re-energize and bring new media attention to architecture all over the world. Architects were still looking for a direction after the breakdown of the modern movement and the repeated false starts of postmodernism, and the profession needed a boost badly. The new Guggenheim took a fresh, dynamic direction. Architecture, whose appeal resided in ravishing large-scale curves made possible with digital design software, a new development, and perfectly suited to architectural photography and display in the pages of newspapers and magazines. Suddenly, cities and museums clamored to hire Frank Gehry or other top-tier star architects, nicknamed Starkitects, to try to replicate the attention and tourism dollars, the new Guggenheim. That windfall had its own nickname, the Bilbao Effect. After the Guggenheim Bilbao, Gehry had a number of subsequent architectural triumphs. They included the 2003 opening of the long-delayed Disney Hall in Los Angeles, designed before the Bilbao but completed after it, and the Fisher Center for the Performing Arts at Bard College in New York. Disney Hall in L.A. was his answer to the charge he was better at producing architectural sculpture than making practical or functional buildings. The Disney Concert Hall is a brilliant, eye-catching piece that filled a literal and symbolic civic hole at the top of Bunker Hill in L.A. It holds an auditorium, however, that functions superbly in acoustic terms. It's given the Los Angeles Philharmonic a new visibility and stature. The Disney Hall is a luminous public landmark, but a workhorse of a building. Similarly powerful was another late-in-life triumph for Gehry, the Fondation Louis Vuitton in Paris, a museum built to hold the collection of the French business magnate and art collector Bernard Arnault. What Gehry's late projects have in common is not only virtuosity in form-making, but a remarkable kind of humanism. This was the best-kept secret of Gehry's career. He was so dedicated and skilled at the basic task of architecture, which is to create spaces respecting and accommodating human scale. Gehry was born Frank Owen Goldberg in 1929 in Toronto, Canada. Gehry's dad, Irving, was a salesman and truck driver who trained as a boxer and moved to Canada from New York, his hometown, as a young guy. Gehry's mother, Thelma, was born in Poland and immigrated to Toronto with her family as a child. Gehry's mother exposed him to music and art. Her parents, Leah and Samuel Kaplan, spent a lot of time with Gehry in Toronto when he was a child. Gehry's urge to reinvent order was born in the back room of his grandfather's hardware store in downtown Toronto. The Jewish kid tinkered with dismembered clocks and toasters, and the pathos of dismantled gears, springs, and wires infected him with a tenderness for mechanisms that spill their guts for all the world to see. Quite a quote about Frank Gehry. He finished high school in 1947 at age 17 and moved with his parents to L.A. His dad had been told by a doctor to move to a gentler climate and ease up on physical labor, and so it was Los Angeles. L.A., when I got here, it was brash, raucous frontier, Geary said about 1947 Los Angeles. Carny business, the movies. Development was vast and rampant. Whole neighborhoods seemed to spring up instantly in desert locations. For Geary, this chaotic cityscape represented a kind of openness and freedom. It was risk-taking. There was an edge to it. Some of it was greedy and awful, but some of it was positive and moving. In 1951, Geary became a naturalized U.S. citizen, having moved here from Canada. The following year, he and Anita Snyder, a young woman he met delivering furniture to her parents' house while working as a driver, got married. They eventually divorced in 1966. It was Anita, Frank Geary said, who convinced him in 1954 to change his last name from Goldberg to the less Jewish-sounding name of Geary, which is Swiss-German. Geary said his wife and mother helped him select that name from a group of names that started with G. He liked his initials, F-O-G, Fog, and didn't want to give them up. I learned I was passed over from an architectural fraternity because I was a Jew, Geary said. I didn't care. But it was evidence of anti-Semitism to me. Then a guy I knew came to me and said, change your name, we can start a partnership. That kind of stuff is what pushed my ex-wife to lobby for a name change and why I finally gave in. In L.A., construction of the Disney Concert Hall was long delayed by the city, but when it was finally completed, that achievement helped him win the Pritzker Prize, architecture's top honor, in 1989. By the way, the Pritzker family, also Jewish. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews Round the World. We welcome back to Two Jewish our guest this morning. Rabbi Stuart Weinblatt is the founder and chairman of Zionist Rabbinic Coalition, which was founded 2020, just 5 years ago. He's Rabbi Emeritus of Congregation B'nai Tzedek, a conservative congregation he founded back in 1988. At least that's what the website says, which has something like 600 families now. He's held a number of leadership posts in local and national organizations in the Washington, D.C. area, was former president of the Rabbinic Cabinet of the Jewish Federations of North America, was the first chairman of the Jewish National Fund's Rabbis for Israel, and I knew there was a reason I liked you. Also was a history major as an undergraduate. So tell us a little bit about how the Zionist Rabbinic Coalition works.
Sure. We sponsor a number of different programs and activities and so on for rabbis and for lay leaders as well, but primarily devoted to rabbis. Our most important and popular activities probably are our national spring conference, which we held in Washington, D.C., usually the end of April or beginning of May. We'll hold it at the end of April this year, which brings together rabbis to be able to be in the D.C. area, to hear from leading policy experts, to network, and to be reminded that they're not that pro-Israel rabbis are not alone, that there are others out there. We also have had a national high holiday seminar where we study together and learn, and again, hear from some leading experts on contemporary issues, as well as to study together. So in addition to these in-person things, we take missions, as we've now done, to Bahrain, to the UAE, and now to Azerbaijan, as well as to Israel. We provide materials and resources, including a weekly email that we send out called News You Can Use, which is a helpful way of looking at and seeing different aspects of the things, the innovations that are taking place in Israel, and that keep us informed. And the last thing I mentioned is we sponsor webinars, and many of these things are available on our website as well, which is ZionistRabbis.org.
By the way, I kind of think I first came into your material with that News We Could Use and the weekly emails, which are extremely informative, well put together, and just give a clear perspective on Israel, pro-Israel, but extraordinary amount of information as well. The missions that you've begun to organize, not just begun, you've done now several. Tell us about how you decided to do those and how those work.
The countries we visited other than Israel have really been an outgrowth of the relationship between these countries and the Jewish community, as well as Israel. So after the signing of the Abraham Accords, at one of our conferences, we happened to be hosted by the ambassador of the UAE for a beautiful, exquisite luncheon. And out of that came the invitation to bring a delegation, a leading delegation of rabbis, or a delegation of leading rabbis, to the UAE to see firsthand the fruits of the Abraham Accords, to see that peace is possible between Israel and its Arab and Muslim nations. And so we visited the UAE and Bahrain in the summer of 2023, so prior to October 7th. And then we traveled to Israel from there. We also then, most recently, just were in Azerbaijan. And that also, similarly, was an outgrowth of conversations with Azerbaijan's ambassador here in Washington to the United States, who wanted us to see firsthand the relations of a Muslim country, a Shiite majority Muslim country, with Israel. And so these have been important opportunities when we've been there to both represent the American Jewish community, to also, in some small, quiet kind of a way, show appreciation on behalf of Israel, and to show the unity that exists between us.
Having been on that Azerbaijan mission, I can tell you it's really extraordinary. It really almost felt like a state visit.
Yeah, it did, didn't it? Yeah, we were, you know, received when we got off the airplane. We were escorted into a VIP lounge and did not have to go through passport control the way people normally would, and were just escorted throughout our visit there. We met in an ornate hall of the parliament with top legislators there. We met with the individual who was the national security advisor and probably closest advisor to the president. So there were really these high-level meetings. You're right. It did feel, in certain respects, and the cover, the respect that we were given, I think is reflective of how seriously they take the relationship with Israel as well as with the American Jewish community and rabbis. So we have a very important role we can play, and that is to help to give oxygen to these kinds of positive developments so that Israel is not alone and is not isolated.
You know, I think there's a stereotype that if you want to hear what's wrong in the world, you should go talk to a rabbi.
Yeah.
That's not what this is about, and that's a choice, isn't it?
Yeah, I believe very strongly in the notion that several things. Number one, I tell our colleagues that we don't love Israel because she is perfect, nor do we need Israel to be perfect for us to love her. And it's important that any expressions of criticism that one may have not be louder than expressions of love. So to try and understand that when that rabbis can either bring people closer to Israel or they can turn them off. We happen to believe that when there are negative things that are constantly being said from the pulpit or by rabbis, it doesn't really have a positive or constructive impact. If anything, it turns people off to even wanting to be Jewish and part of the Jewish people. So I think that what we try and do is to say, let's work constructively. You know, there is so much out there in the general media and in social media that is so highly charged anti-Israel, anti-Jewish people, often controlled by other outside sources, let's say. But the point is, we want to counter that. We want to present the response to the disinformation campaign that takes place against Israel.
Now, the rabbis, in my experience, from really all across the country, there are people from the East Coast, the West Coast, the Midwest. One rabbi from Arizona, I can't remember who that was, but none of us are, these are bright people, educated, highly aware of what's going on, understanding of policy, and this is an opportunity to kind of glimpse behind the curtain. I don't think anybody came away discouraged or less than impressed with some of the great work that's going on in many ways, except perhaps in one area. In addressing anti-Semitism, which has clearly become such a central issue, talk a little bit about some of those discussions that took place in Israel.
Sure. One of the things I want to mention, by the way, apropos of what you just said, is one of the highlights of the Zionist Rabbinic Coalition has been our access, whether it is in foreign capitals or the capital of the United States in Washington, D.C., or when we visit in Israel. In previous missions, we've met with the prime minister, with the foreign minister, and the president, and other leading figures. And so that's a very critical part of what we offer our rabbis as well. In regard to the area of anti-Semitism, there were several meetings that we had discussing that, one with the people in the foreign ministry who are working on that, also in conversations with columnist and writers Melanie Phillips and Michal Kotler-Wunsch, who had been up until a month earlier Israel's envoy to combat anti-Semitism.
Yeah, she was incredible, I thought.
Yes, yes. And I think, you know, one of the things that was impressed upon us was that Israel has been fighting a seven-front war in terms of Iran, Hezbollah, Hamas, the Houthis, Syria, Iraq, et cetera, all of the, you know, confrontational states. But there's an eighth front, and the eighth front is the global anti-Semitism, the global effort to delegitimize Israel, the global effort to intimidate supporters of Israel and Jews. And so part of our takeaway, I think, was that we, that is rabbis and lovers and supporters of Israel, non-rabbis as well, are soldiers in that eighth battlefront, combating the misimpressions, the misinformation, and the efforts to really delegitimize the state of Israel and the Jewish people.
That effort, and well, I guess I should say the counter-effort that rabbis and Jews really all over America need to respond to and all over the world, what kind of a message could you give and could you gain from this experience? But also, what kind of a message would the Zionist Rabbinic Coalition want people to know?
I think part of it is that, for one, that our opinions and our feelings about Israel, we should not allow our opinions and feelings about Israel to be determined by Israel's detractors and enemies, not just by what we read in the press, in other words, but we have to go deeper than that. And I think part of that message also is, you know, most American Jews, and certainly American rabbis, have either friends or relatives who are Israelis, many of whom have been fighting in Gaza and defending the country and elsewhere. We know these people. We know, therefore, that the lies that are promulgated about the so-called atrocities and so-called genocide just are not plain true. And so I think we have that responsibility in any way that we can to bring about a different message, to make sure that positive things that we saw there are heard. And the decency of Israeli society and of Israeli people is not forgotten, even in the midst of all the discussions, arguments, disputations, divisions that exist in Israel about the best way forward. Nevertheless, there's still this basic humanity that's there. You know, one of the people in the Gaza envelope had said, we heard about a story where he said that he heard about somebody who came from the settlements as soon as they heard that they were being attacked in the Gaza on October 7th. And he said it was a wake-up call for me because I don't know if I would have rushed to help them. And so at the end of the day, Israelis come to realize that they are one people, and similarly with those of us living on this other side of the Atlantic. That's our family. It's, as someone said, it's not so much a country as much as it is a big family.
It's a big family, sometimes a big dysfunctional family, right?
But you got to love your family one way or the other.
Of course. The reality is that as we become more aware and experience Israel, those of us who have been committed to Israel for a long time become more committed. It's challenged with some of the younger generation now, isn't it?
Yes, yeah. They get so much of their information from social media, TikTok and Instagram, and the more we're learning, the more we're finding out that the fact that they are bombarded with so many negative images is not coincidental. That there are, I hate to say it and I hate to sound conspiratorial, but there are sinister forces who are promoting these kinds of things. And so they are especially susceptible to the anti-Israel propaganda. And we just have to cut through that. We have to counter. We can't give up on them.
More than not giving up, we have to find a way to address them, don't we?
Absolutely. You know, I mean, the story of Israel is an amazing story. It's a story of rebirth. It's a story of resilience. It's the story of returning to our indigenous homeland. It's a story of creating a language. It's a story of welcoming refugees from around the world. There are those who have said it really is everything that the progressive left would want to celebrate. But the problem is that Israel is successful and has chosen not to remain a victim. And so there is much, much to celebrate in terms of its accomplishments as well as its contributions to the world. It's the ultimate Tikkun Olam story.
We are seeking to repair the world, and Jews now have a homeland, no matter what else happens in the world.
And one of the things in a previous visit to Sam that we had learned about was the extraordinary efforts on Israel's part to take their agricultural knowledge around the world, to take their development of irrigation and drip irrigation. In fact, by the way, while we were there, there was a young man whose body was returned to Tanzania who had been come to Israel just like a week or two before October 7th in order to study its agriculture. He was an agricultural student or practitioner,
right,
and he was very excited to be in Israel to learn, to be able to take back to his country in Africa some of the innovations of Israel. And it just shows the cruelty of Hamas. They didn't care. They murdered him as well. They held his body until just a couple of weeks ago. And so when we talk about, you know, the contributions Israel makes to so many different areas, including agriculture and science and medicine, if only the world would be open to it. And that's one of the things about going to a place like the UAE and Bahrain and Azerbaijan, where instead of being in a confrontational state with Israel, they recognize they have far more to gain by not battling in war against Israel.
I want to thank Rabbi Stuart Weinblatt for a great visit here on Two Jewish. Where can people find out more about the Zionist Rabbinic Coalition and the information that you send out regularly?
We have a website. It's very easy to find. It's called ZionistRabbis.org. And on our website, we post a number of the webinars that we have conducted, the conversations with experts, as well as articles and other kinds of material. So please do go on to ZionistRabbis.org. You're welcome to become a friend of the Zionist Rabbi Rabbinic Coalition, or if you're a rabbi, to actually join.
Thank you so much, Stuart. A great pleasure to talk to you. Thank you again for a fantastic trip, and I look forward to seeing you again soon.
Thank you, and thanks so much for being a part of a really wonderful experience. You added a great deal to it, so I'm glad you were part of it. Thank you.
My honor. When we come back on Two Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical playout.
The stories we share last a lifetime and are passed down from generation to generation. Known for our compassionate commitment to the families we serve, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has faithfully served the Tucson community and the Jewish community for over 100 years. We help thousands of families plan and carry out celebrations of loved ones in unique and special ways and assist them in sharing those lifetimes of stories meaningfully. The most beautiful and tranquil final resting place in all of southern Arizona, Evergreen's tall pines shade peaceful grassy fields. You can count on Evergreen for superior service and the highest degree of integrity. Our informative, well-trained staff is here to assist you with a full range of on-site services. Call Evergreen. 520-888-7470, 520-888-7470. While we serve the whole community, our experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. We have sections dedicated to all religious faiths, can help you arrange for your future needs or your immediate ones. Whether you choose to hold a traditional funeral service or a completely individualized ceremony, either in person or online or both, our goal is to help you create a meaningful, personalized service based upon your unique needs in a place of reflection, tradition, and serenity. Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best to the community and to you. Call 520-888-7470. To speak to a family advisor at Evergreen, call 520-888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Two Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next week for another great edition of Two Jewish. Our guest will be Professor Samuel G. Friedman, prominent author and journalist on the 25th anniversary of his seminal book, Jew vs. Jew, The Struggle for the Soul of American Jewry. And please join us, Congregation Beit Simcha, each Friday night for services in Oneg Shabbat at 6:30 p.m., Saturday morning, too, 9 a.m. Torah study, 10 a.m. services, Torah reading and Kiddush, in person and on our Facebook page. My friends, Hanukkah starts tonight at sunset. Our playout this morning comes from our pre-Hanukkah preview of music for the Festival of Lights and Latkes. It's a parody of the K-pop trend. Apparently that includes demon hunting. This is by the a cappella group 613. It's called Hanukkah Golden. Join us for Congregation Beit Simcha's 7th anniversary celebration, Saturday night, December 20th at 5 p.m. Let there be light. Go to BeitSimchaTucson.org, B-E-I-T-S-I-M-C-H-A, Tucson.org, and sign up for the best Hanukkah celebration in Arizona, and come to our virtual Hanukkah menorah lighting at 5:30 p.m. each night on our Facebook page. My friends, enjoy a Chag Chanukah Sameach, Chag Urim Sameach, a happy Chanukah, a joyous festival of lights and latkes, and a Shavua Tov, a good week, a healthy week, and a week we pray profoundly of peace.
Too Jewish is sponsored by Too Jewish Radio Programs, Tucson, Arizona.
So long ago we were controlled, couldn't learn, couldn't pray. Greece at the throne, we'd been deposed, we believed, led by the brave Judah Maccabee.